This community of will is traceable throughout the entire history of mankind. Everywhere we find the original disposition of all the nomads alike, Nordic, Semitic, or Mongolian, was individually more willing and more erect than that of the settled folk. The Nordic peoples came into Italy and Greece under leader kings. They didn't bring any systematic temple cults with them. They found such things in the conquered lands and adapted as they adopted them. The Greeks and Latins lapsed very easily again into republics, and so did the Aryans in India. There was a tradition of election also in the early Frankish and German kingdoms, so the decision was usually taken between one or other members of a royal caste or family. The early caliphs were elected. The judges of Israel and the kings of Carthage and Tyre were elected. And so was the great Khan of the Mongols, until Kublai became a Chinese monarch. Equally constant in the settled lands do we find the opposite idea, the idea of a non-elective divinity in kings and of their natural and inherent right to rule. As our history has developed, we've noted the appearance of new and complicating elements in the story of human societies. We've seen that nomad turned go-between, the trader appear, and we've noted the growing importance of shipping in the world. It seems as inevitable that voyaging should make men free in their minds as that settlement within a narrow horizon should make men timid and servile. But in spite of all such complications, the broad antagonism between the method of obedience and the method of will runs through history down into our own times. To this day, their reconciliation is incomplete. Civilization, even in its most servile forms, has always offered much that's enormously attractive, convenient, and congenial to mankind. But something restless and untamed in our race has striven continually to convert civilization from its original reliance upon unparticipating obedience into a community of participating wills. And to the lurking nomadism in our blood, and particularly in the blood of monarchs and aristocracies, we must ascribe also that incessant urgency towards a wider range that forces every state to extend its boundaries if it can, and to spread its interests to the ends of the earth. The power of nomadic restlessness that tends to bring all the earth under one rule seems to be identical with the spirit that makes most of us chafe under direction and restraint, and seek to participate in whatever government we tolerate. And this natural, this temperamental struggle of mankind to reconcile civilization with freedom has been kept alive age after age by the military and political impotence of every community of obedience that has ever existed. Obedience, once men are broken to it, can be easily captured and transferred. Witness the passive role of Egypt, Mesopotamia, and India, the original and typical lands of submission, the cradles of civilization as they passed from one lordship to another. A servile civilization is a standing invitation to predatory free men. But on the other hand, a community of will necessitates a fusion of intractable materials. It's a far harder community to bring about, and still more difficult to maintain. The story of Alexander the Great displays the community of will of the Macedonian captains gradually dissolving before his demand that they should worship him. The incident of the murder of Cletus is quite typical of the struggle between the free and the servile tradition that went on whenever a new conqueror from the open lands and the open air found himself installed in the palace of an ancient monarchy. In the case of the Roman Republic, History tells of the first big community of will in the world's history, the first free community, much larger than a city, and how it weakened with growth and spent itself upon success, until at last it gave way to a monarchy of the ancient type, and decayed swiftly into one of the feeblest communities of servitude that ever collapsed before a handful of invaders. We've given some attention in this book to the factors in that decay, because they are of primary importance in human history. One of the most evident was the want of any wide organization of education to base the ordinary citizens' minds upon the idea of service and obligation to the Republic, to keep them willing, that is. Another was the absence of any medium of general information to keep their activities in harmony, to enable them to will as one body. The community of will is limited in size by the limitations set upon the possibilities of a community of knowledge. The concentration of property in a few hands and the replacement of free workers by slaves were rendered possible by the decay of public spirit and the confusion of the public intelligence that resulted from these limitations. There was, moreover, no efficient religious idea behind the Roman state. The dark Etruscan liver-peering cult of Rome was as little adapted to the political needs of a great community as the very similar shamanism of the Mongols. It is in the fact that both Christianity and Islam, in their distinctive ways, did at least promise to supply, for the first time in human experience, this patent gap in the Roman Republican system, as well as in the nomadic system, to give a common moral education for a mass of people and to supply them with a common history of the past and a common idea of a human purpose and destiny, that their enormous historical importance lies. Aristotle, as we've noted, had set a limit to the ideal community of a few thousand citizens because he couldn't conceive how a larger multitude could be held together by a common idea. He had had no experience of any sort of education beyond the tutorial methods of his time. Greek education was almost purely viva voce education. It could reach, therefore, only to a limited aristocracy. Both the Christian Church and Islam demonstrated the unsoundness of Aristotle's limitation. We may think they did their task of education in their vast fields of opportunity crudely or badly, but the point of interest to us is that they did it at all. Both sustained almost worldwide propagandas of idea and inspiration. Both relied successfully upon the power of the written word to link great multitudes of diverse men together in common enterprises. By the 11th century, as we've seen, the idea of Christendom had been imposed upon all the vast warring miscellany of the smashed and pulverized Western Empire, and upon Europe far beyond its limits, as a uniting and inspiring idea. It had made a shallow but effective community of will over an unprecedented area and out of an unprecedented multitude of human beings. Only one other thing at all like this had ever happened to any great section of mankind before, and that was the idea of a community of good behavior that the literati had spread throughout China. The Catholic Church provided what the Roman Republic had lacked, a system of popular teaching, a number of universities, and methods of intellectual intercommunication. By this achievement, it opened the way to the new possibilities of human government that now become apparent in this outline, possibilities that are still being apprehended and worked out in the world in which we are living.